Because they're here for us.
Good morning, everybody. Today is
crazy.
May 18th, 2017, and welcome to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. We have the bulk of the last batch of bills. May have a couple more trickle in from rules, but this is probably the last big hearing on public hearing. Several bills and a few bills to work. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 101B. Cassie, please read the summary.
Senate Bill 101B prohibits school personnel from disclosing existence of and information related to child abuse investigations conducted on school grounds while the investigation is pending. The bill provides that Department of Human Services or a law enforcement agency conducting the investigation is not required to reveal information about the investigation to school personnel. This applies the statute to private schools as well and excludes investigations or interviews of persons suspected of committing abuse from the application of the statute. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage. We have a B7 amendment, and the B7 amendment allows a school administrator or school staff member to testify at subsequent court proceeding or to be interviewed prior to the court proceeding.
Okay, so I have Lucinda Heights Claybaugh, Gail Meyer, and Stacey Ayers.
Good morning. My name is Stacey Ayers. I'm the Child Protective Services Manager for the Department of Human Services. This is actually a legislative concept that I originally had introduced. Came from the department. We had been experiencing some our Child Protective Services workers going out to do investigations, and law enforcement, I might add, going out to do investigations at schools. They were, in many instances, being blocked by the schools from interviewing children and the schools notifying parents, even in situations where the school knew that the perpetrator, sometimes in cases like sex abuse or other physical abuse allegations, were notifying the parent or the perpetrator, alleged perpetrator as it were, that we were there intending to interview the child. So it was really compromising investigations and compromising child safety. So that was one of the elements we were trying to address when we put this forward. Another issue that we were trying to address is the fact that in the current statute as it stands, it refers to public school premises. And so what would happen is CPS investigators, and this is a longstanding issue. I've been with the agency for 22 years, and most of that has been conducting child abuse investigations. And as an investigator, I experienced this myself, going to private schools and having the challenge put to me of, what is your statutory authority to do this? What is your statutory authority to be here to interview a child? And you pull out the statute, and of course it says public school premises. I think the legislative intent was clear, that the expectation is that it doesn't matter where the premises is, if it's at a home or a school or anything else. And so this is really kind of an attempt to fix some language, I think, and to make it so that, you know, we have a number of barriers that make our job very difficult. And this was just another one of them, of those barriers that I hoped, and I think with a lot of collaborative work with the OCDLA and law enforcement, and I know I am forgetting somebody at this point. Department of Justice was involved in our conversations, and the DA's Association. And I think we came to what we believe is a fairly good compromise. There's some language in this in the bill that you have before you that is, I think, for us, we believe meets the need. So,
thank you. Good morning. Chair Kinnegeyer, member of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'd like to thank Mr. Ayers and others at DHS for coordinating with us and discussing this bill. OCDLA represents many different people in this whole context. We represent the child and the dependency. We represent the parents and the dependency. We represent a child who might be suspected of abuse and delinquency. And we represent the adults who might be the suspects of abuse. And so we saw this from surround sound. With the B7 amendment, however, our interests will be made whole, and we would ask the committee to accept the B7 amendment, and then we would be fine and neutral with the bill. Thank you. The being engrossed does represent one of our requested amendments already. Subsection 2 simply clarifies that this is where their DHS and law enforcement is accessing a child whom they suspect to be a victim or a witness, but not when they suspect the child is the abuser themselves. So we've carved that out. Then what the B7 does is it clarifies language of when people can discuss this. So there's, I've been calling it the gag order language. It's an extreme term, I admit. So, but whatever, on lines 15, 16, 17 of the Be Engrossed, it clarifies people may not discuss this investigation or anything learned during it. But then what the B7 clarifies is that they can testify in a court proceeding and they can be interviewed prior to a court proceeding. Sometimes these people do become fact witnesses, and it's important to know what they know. So it clarifies when they cannot talk, when they can talk. And so we would encourage the acceptance of the B7 amendment, and then our interests will be made whole. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. My name is Lucinda Heights Claybaugh. And I am a volunteer. I have advocated on Innocence Project cases in the state of Arizona. I am myself a person who was falsely accused of a crime. And if this bill goes through, you'll see more people who are wrongfully accused of crimes just as I was. And this is why I'm here to tell you not to pass this bill as it is. It would need an awful lot more tweaking as far as I'm concerned, and I'll tell you why. Because it does not follow the interpretation that I have and that people who would be trying to defend people through the Innocence Project, people who have actually later been found to be innocent and are now exonerees. And they have all found themselves, not all, but over 90% of them, is what Barry Sheck and Peter Neufeld had told us, over 90% of them had been put in situations because there wasn't an unbiased, fair, thorough investigation. And because when there was the beginning of an investigation, it wasn't recorded. And it needs to be fully recorded. The protocols, and these are the protocols right here. These are our State of Oregon medical guidelines for evaluation of sexual abuse in children and adolescents. It is also the Oregon State interviewing guidelines. The best practices in these protocols actually say, hold on there, folks. If you go charging in with guns on and uniforms, you're going to create a power dynamic of authority figures that will taint that witness. That kid is not going to be able to give the same statement as if it had been held in a calm, two-way mirror, Cares Northwest, Liberty House situation for the initial interview. When you come into a school grounds and charge in like that, you are affecting the school environment, and you are going to be affecting and tainting that witness. And to say that you're not is not true. There is a lot of evidence now on cases for exonerees where people did come in and do just that, and they destroyed that kid's statement. They destroyed that kid as a fair witness because that presumes guilt. When you come charging in that way and think that you can destroy somebody's constitutional rights and ignore them and set up the situation where there will be leading questions, where the kid will be deferent to authority, they can't help but be deferent to that kind of authority, especially when you have a situation of kids of different races and the social esteem and different power dynamics of that. So there are a lot of figures that need to be looked at a little bit more carefully here. The protocols themselves actually say that the authority that DHS or law enforcement has applies only for as long as a reasonable danger to a child exists. Now, in a school situation, is there really that kind of a danger? Be real, please. That, you know that that's not the case. They are in a safe situation in the school environment. Unless there is a specific person that has been found and they're with that person, and that's the person that is a suspected perpetrator. So to come in and not tell the school officials what's going on is inappropriate. They do need to know. And to withhold that information and say you can't disclose this information until we're ready for court proceedings presumes guilt. Put yourself for a moment in the shoes of a person who's being falsely accused. Oh, well, that would never happen to me. Ah, but it could, because it happened to me. And I would never have dreamed that I would be falsely accused of something. And almost everybody who is falsely accused cannot understand what on earth are they talking about? What's going on here? But if you don't have that information, you can't even put together a fair defense. Every single one of you that has law enforcement background knows you will be tainting that witness. It is in the best interest of everyone for a good, clean case to have no person with a, that hasn't had a fully recorded testimony. So that very initial contact has to be fully recorded. That's what the protocols say. And they can't just be by a DHS person or a law enforcement person who has only 40 hours of training. Someone was saying, oh, we've had 40 hours of training. I'm sorry, but a master's degree in counseling and therapy, specifically a highly qualified, it gives again the in the protocols, we're talking a highly qualified MD psychiatrist, psychiatric nurse practitioner. We're talking about a highly qualified master's degree, at least, if not a doctorate, with specialized training in mental health therapy that is related to forensic assessment on top of the medical examination piece. They're not supposed to go charging in. They are not qualified to do so. Not to ask questions that are not leading. The protocols go very carefully how you have training in not having leading questions. It takes more than 40 hours to do that.
Okay, so Lucinda, thank you. Do you have questions?
Does anybody have questions
well,
on that?
Not so much. I'm trying to kind of work this out a little bit, and Stacy and Yale, stay with me here. I'm going to try to kind of play this out a little bit. I understand, Stacy, what you're trying to do with the B-17s here on this whole thing and what the intent of the original bill was. I appreciate, Gail, your input on this whole thing. So I'm at a school. You receive a report from a mandatory reporter.
Sure.
Kid, I think this is a typical scenario.
Yes.
There's been some child abuse involved.
An allegation.
That's right. Okay, right. Thank you. An allegation surfaces, and you show up at the school. School still has this obligation to have to care and protect the child. Mm-hmm. Work this out with me a little bit. How this is all going to play out with what you're wanting to try to do with this bill for your responsibility for the protection, but also in the connection with what the school has to do
sure.
in protecting the child in that safe haven.
Chair Kinnegeyer, Vice Chair Olson, thank you for the question. It's a great question. I don't think anything that really has happened in this legislation. In fact, I think what the biggest struggle that we were having is a carryover from Green versus Camretta, which is a case that was vacated in the Supreme Court, originally kind of decided in the Ninth Circuit, and then vacated at the Supreme Court level. So essentially what we believe was starting to happen is a carryover from that decision, and schools becoming more, in a sense, adversarial to not just our presence child welfare or CPS, but also law enforcement. And so what we're having is this inconsistency of application of what they believed Green versus Camerota actually still being, they believed still being in effect to some degree. And so essentially what you would have is, in some instances, and I'm trying to be responsive, and I'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
So what you would have in some instances was, if we responded and we didn't have law enforcement with us, the schools would say, you can't interview the child unless you have law enforcement there. You go to the next county over in a different district, and they would say, you can talk to the child, but not if law enforcement's here. Right? And so essentially what we're trying to get is to a place where it was clear that the authority granted in 419B is clear that we respond to allegations of child abuse, as does law enforcement. There is no presumed guilt. There is an interview that takes place in instances, as is cited, where disclosures are made. And be clear, we respond to, we receive over 70,000 to 80,000 reports a year. Only about half of those are assigned because they meet a standard or a threshold of a statutory allegation. So they fit within some type of allegation. The response then, we go out, and only less than a third of that number that we respond to actually end up being founded. So there's clearly not a preconceived notion that these that the allegation is in fact true. So we have to go out, and not every instance is it responding at the school, but many are. And so, but to your question, you know, understanding that everybody has a role in making sure it's not just us that makes sure kids are safe, I think that the concern that we were having is that the schools were wanting to notify parents, and at times there's kind of a privacy issue about these, where you don't want the schools to have information that may bias them, essentially, because now they have information that the child has allegedly been sexually abused. Well, that changes their perspective about the family and things like that, when it may not be actually true. And so we're trying to be kind of thoughtful and cautious about that, and trying to do whatever we can in the way of an interview that isn't doesn't create, and there's no way to can absolutely remove a power differential, right? But you do that to the degree you can. If you do get a disclosure, the Oregon interviewing guidelines and the protocols that are established in every county are to get the child in to a designated medical professional, to a setting where you have kind of the expert level forensic type interviews. And I would just add that in many instances, those centers, the interviews conducted are by DHS, CPS staff, and law enforcement. Okay, so it is a really difficult and precarious balance, but it is one that we struggle with every day and we take very seriously. And I hope I was responsive enough to your question. I'm not sure if you want to go further into it.
Gail might catch it.
Okay.
Thank you, Vice Chair Olson and members of the committee, Gail Meyer. There's way more than one issue present in this bill,
sure.
And you've heard way more than one issue presented in testimony. One thing the bill does, it expands the premises upon which the DHS and law enforcement can come in from public schools to include private schools. OCDLA has no position on that. Another thing it does is it says that when they come through the door, they don't have to reveal anything at all about their investigation to the school administrators. That's a policy issue. OCDLA doesn't have a position on that, but that is another piece of this bill that's before you. there's another piece of the bill that says that the school administrators and staff members kind of have a gag order. They can't talk about this. They can't notify any person. They can't reveal anything in there. This is where the B7 amendment protects people who get caught up in the system thereafter as a fact witness. What you've also heard presented to you by Ms. Heitz Claybaugh is a concern that at these initial interviews occurring at the schools, what's happening in there? Because they're not being recorded. And I don't know if this committee knows anything at all about Ms. Heitz Claybaugh's prosecution, but I've spoken with her attorneys. Things went very wrong in her case right around here. They went very wrong. And they had a child who was making inconsistent statements. English was her second language, not being interviewed by somebody proficient in her first language. It was a disaster zone, and things didn't get unraveled until she was in custody in prison for 3 years on a sex abuse. So things can go wrong here, and when they do, it's very consequential. It's not in the bill. What Ms. Heitz Claybaugh is saying is these initial contacts with these children are huge, because what's happened is DHS has gotten a mandatory report from someone. They don't know whether it's founded in fact or not. They can't launch straight over into an assessment in Liberty House and CARES. You have to first have some indication to know, is there reasonable suspicion here or not? And this is that step. When DHS and law enforcement chooses to access that child in a school setting, because the child is there, the suspected possible perpetrator isn't, it's a controlled environment, they choose the school, they pull the kid out, they start asking the kid, it's not being recorded. And that really is the substance of what Ms. Heitz Claybaugh was saying, but it's not in the bill. We think it's a very important conversation. We didn't think this bill was the right avenue or venue to present the issue.
Thank you.
Representative Stark?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then Representative Noble after that.
Stacey, you covered this for the most part. I want to make sure I'm understanding properly. And a comment for just in related to what Mrs. Myers just said is it is important that we have these well-done assessments, but somewhere there has to be a conversation that indicates take this person for an assessment. So I would say my question for you, Stacey, is and you covered this, but maybe more direct on it. Why is it important to at times interview or have a conversation with a minor without their parent present? And how often do those end up getting referred to the assessment centers? And if there is a concern, do you ever proceed without referring them to a assessment center?
Vice Chair, or Chair Geyer, Representative Stark, again, thank you for the question. There are a few questions in there, and I'm going to try to remember them, and if I don't get to them, please redirect me. So it is important at times, not every time, but it is important at times in certain instances to interview children without the presence of their parent, who may be the alleged perpetrator. In many instances, is the alleged perpetrator. The other, as many people who are involved in investigations, who do investigations, who are interviewers at assessment centers, et cetera, will tell you, when you have parents or other individuals involved in an interview, sometimes what happens is there's nonverbal cues that go on, there's body language that goes on, there's actual comments made, answering questions for the child. It's a very difficult setting to have control over in a situation where you've got a lot of emotions involved, and so you're trying to ask questions that are not leading, and to see essentially what will be said, and to do that in a way that doesn't get influenced by other outside individuals. So that's kind of the first thing. The as to how many of these cases actually get referred to the assessment centers, I don't have that like raw number offhand. We could get that, I think, pretty easily.
if that's something that you want me to look into.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To rephrase that question, if there's a decision to move forward with an allegation and continue investigating it, is it that the majority of the time, if that decision is made, are they referred out or are they not referred out for these assessments?
And again, Chair Kinnegeyer, Representative Stark, oftentimes they don't go to the assessment centers. Oftentimes it is we're able to go back to the parents, have the conversations without having a full medical assessment, if you will, and a full interview by a forensic interview. Generally speaking, the cases that end up going through the route of needing to be done at a designated medical professional or child abuse investigation center or intervention center are going to be some of the higher level abuse cases or cases where Carley's Law would be present. But even in those, you may have situations where the parents are still involved in that process. It's not an automatic that, and not to suggest that they would sit in the room while the medical interview is taking place or the assessment is taking place by the designated medical professional, but they may still be involved in the process, bring the child to the center, things like that. So,
thank you.
Representative Noble.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate what this bill's trying to do. My experience, and I think you mentioned it, school district to school district is different in that based on their own litigation experience. And a lot of times, well, I'll talk about my experience in McMinnville in, as a police chief. The relationship between the police department and the school district is critical. And that can change the whole tenor from not being able to do any interviews to being able to have staff in the room and still have confidence that it won't be shared, critical information won't be shared. Because there is this overwhelming need, and sometimes it's based on litigation history, to let the parents and everybody else know what is going on with their child. So I think this is a problem that does need to be solved. Is there anything in this bill that would preclude involving school staff if that was necessary or if that was based on a relationship and a history?
Chair Kinnegeyer, Representative Noble, thank you for the question. No, in fact, I think it doesn't change that that component that existed in the law previously. That's still allowable. If, for instance, you were at a school and we would be asking, are there special needs that this child has? Are there special considerations that we should be aware of? And it could be that the child is, has those special needs, and it is clear they will not talk to anybody. They have this strong relationship with one of the school personnel, and that would be an allowable circumstance for that personnel to be involved in the process. It's not ideal, but it is possible.
And follow up, and this is for Gail. In your in the amendments proposed here, talking about in line four where it says may be interviewed prior to any such court proceeding, any sideboards on that? Is this a news interview? Is this an interview by the parents? Why my children were kept? Does this does it provide any protections? To kind of add some context, I think the schools are reacting again to litigation and want to be able to protect them as they're trying to navigate and ultimately join law enforcement and DHS in doing what's best for the child.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Noble. If you look at the Be Engrossed version, on line 20, it did have a qualifier. It did say may be interviewed by the respective litigants prior to any such court proceeding. And we asked to remove that qualifier because sometimes it's such a multivariate universe, you never know what's coming down the pike. It could be that the investigation doesn't go forward, nothing happens, and then the parents get involved in a custody dispute, and then there's now a custody fight. And so we to answer your question, the B7 does not have a qualifier. The B in gross does. We were concerned that it could be so limiting that it would preclude people from being asked to access if they were a fact witness. So it is meant to include some relevance to an ongoing court proceeding, however. So I don't know if we need to enhance language for you or not.
Just a quick, a quick comment. I understand the delicate balance there to protect the integrity of the investigation, yet not to interfere with other proceedings that may arise, because often it is a multifaceted situation, I guess, that involves more than just the criminal.
So we've got a question over here from Representative Gorsuch and then from Representative Tana Sanchez.
So this is all obviously very delicate, difficult things, but I noticed that you had a couple of responses. I was just wondering what those were.
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Gorsuch. The protocols right now under ORS 418.747 does mention school officers, school officials. So there are school personnel that are a part of the MDT teams. And I was a teacher for 30 years. My experience is that every school has a school counselor. That is the designated MDT team member, because that person does have a master's degree or work on a doctorate. They do have the mental health counseling background. They do have a lot of these trainings, and they've had more than 40 hours in the other assessment pieces because they do all kinds of assessment. I used to be one of those specialists. That's the irony of my case, is I was a person that did do assessments. I did 16 kids that I referred. Okay, but what I did in the process was I made sure as a designated person that you record that initial first interview fully in the same way they would at Liberty House, except that you don't have two-way mirrors. So in the counseling office, the kid walks in the door, they start the tape. They don't stop the tape until the kid walks out that door. There are no Watergate gaps to worry about later in litigation. It's going to be a clean investigation for police if there really is a problem. If there isn't, then you've got that recorded too. You've got the person's innocence recorded as well. And that's important for an innocent person falsely accused. You've got to be able to think about the Constitution a little bit here. We've gone so far in this pendulum swing that we're forgetting that you can have respectful treatment of a complainant and that that's not incompatible with the pursuit of impartial and accurate and honest investigation.
Yes.
The other piece on here that I think is important is if you look at 418.790, and these are the original parts of the old statutes with the protocols, they're talking about a coordinated investigation of child abuse allegations. I don't know how many of you know Ron Louie, who used to work, be the Hillsborough police chief, and he's a wonderful, wonderful man. And he taught everybody, he trained everybody in Hillsborough that you don't just go charging in. Their mantra was, call CARES Northwest. Call CARES Northwest. If you're DHS, you call CARES Northwest. If you're law enforcement, you call CARES Northwest. And why again? Because they have the two-way mirrors. Law enforcement and DHS are welcome to be behind those two-way mirrors. They're listening, they're recording, they're getting the information they need for a good case, and they're making sure all those questions are being asked by that person. If they don't hear something being asked later, then they can go back in a second investigation. The other thing about CARES Northwest centers at Liberty House, you have different rooms. You sequester the family once you step one, I'll go back a little bit. That designated person at the school, who is a counselor, who does have this training and is a highly qualified person, except for the medical piece of the medical examination, which will then be done later as the next step. But in that first step, if the counselor sees, with open-ended questioning from these trainings, that it does not rise to the level of reporting, then you don't waste everybody's time, you don't waste taxpayer money, you don't waste police time, you don't waste all those thousands of dollars of wrongfully putting somebody into a trial. You don't presume their guilt. And the whole process here is, if it were you, what fair processes would you expect the Constitution Bill of Rights to be afforded to you? What would you want?
Allow another question. We're going to have to move to another panel pretty soon.
I just want to clarify something. Several of us on this panel have worked in law enforcement, and the one question I have for you, I know you've focused on 40 hours of training, but I mean, you accept the fact that officers who work in this area for long periods of time have a fair amount of experience in how to deal with these things. Am I right or wrong on that?
They may have a fair amount of experience, but there is a power differential which exists, and when they've gone back and looked at tapes of people who've been exonerated and analyzed them for forensic training mm-hmm. with the National Criminal Defense Lawyers Association and so on, when we have our Innocence Project conferences every year, is you will see that there is presumed guilt, and that pervades and taints the whole direction of questioning and how it goes. And when the kid, if that is happening, they can't do it.
Now, I agree with you on that to some degree. However, I think that's a huge issue that really transcends this. I mean, the whole question of law enforcement imagery and symbolism, we know that that can be a coercive thing. But on the other hand, you still have to have law enforcement and DHS respond to these things.
You have to have them respond, but what they do is they don't turn on their lights. The counselor is the beloved designated MDT member. That counselor at every school is capable of going through the process to determine, is there really reasonable cause here? And when people get in trouble, it's in situations like mine. There was no reasonable cause. If they had investigated at all, they would have seen that, but they didn't. And so there needs to be some simple questioning that is open-ended, does not presume guilt, allows there to be this recorded information. If it rises to, well, obviously, if there's a bruise, you can see there's a bruise, then you can start asking open-ended questions about how that bruise came to be. But in the other cases, you can't, what you're asking for is this really substantiated? When something's substantiated, go for it. So if it's not substantiated, don't.
I'd like to ask one more question of Stacy and then get to the next panel. And obviously, there's more conversation to have after this. But we do have other bills, too. I'm just curious. I know that there are not a lot of counselors in the schools anymore. There may have been when you taught there, and unfortunately, we are not in that situation now. So when you come in to do an initial investigation to see if it's even warranted to take the next step, to take it to a CARES Northwest-type place, and you determine that it is warranted to do a further investigation, what happens? Do you take the child from the school right there? I mean, if the suspected abuse is with the family, that is the reason, I'm presuming, that you're going to the school, a safe place. How does that get arranged?
Chair Kenny-Geyer, members of the committee, thank you for the question. It often depends on the circumstances. It often depends on what is said, how it's said. It may be that you have one parent who is protective and another one who is abusive. Mm-hmm. And it may be then that the next steps are coordinating potentially with a non-offending parent. It could be that the circumstances are so severe that you may need to place the child in protective custody at that point and go immediately to an assessment center.
Okay.
All of those things are they're factors that are taken into consideration.
But there needs to be some level of a determination to even do a protective custody order in order to transport them to a center.
Right. Yes.
So that's the stage at which we're trying to figure out what's the appropriate. So I want to move on to the next panel here. I'm very fortunate to have four people on this committee who are on judiciary. So that's helpful. But these are issues that I don't normally deal with. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have Lori Satinspiel and Amanda Dalton.
Chair Kenny-Geyer, members of the committee, Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Boards here today to speak to you about 101B. And I still first want to thank Representative Olson, Representative Stark, and Representative Noble for their questions. Safety is always first for students. They come into our schools. We're supposed to take care of them. I think for me, boiling this down to school districts that have trouble when folks come in, and I think Representative Noble, you spoke to this, is the litigation piece. If the district does something wrong and they pull a student and that person who's before us is not who they say they are, they're not there for the reason they, you know, something goes wrong, we're going to be sued. So our protection is a form we use, and this form has been the source of the problem. I think I've got it on OLIS. It's a generic form, but districts have the opportunity to take that form and maneuver it a little bit. So the initial form has folk come in before them, and it may be a secretary and or somebody, and they say, I need to pull Johnny out of class. And they say, okay, you know, here's the form we need you to sign, because the district in our OER says you have to keep track of all reports and incidents that of child abuse investigations. And so this would qualify. And so I think the form, which was designed after the Green Camaretta also of the case, and our general counsel at the time said that this the case was vacated, so it was moot as far as they're concerned, and so they continued to use the form. We've been working offline with DHS to say, let's come up with a better form that meets their needs, because right now we've got some caseworkers coming in and want to interview students, pull them out, waiving Senate Bill 101A and saying, I don't have to sign your form. So we've got a little adversarial stuff going on here. So we want to try to solve it. We want to keep kids safe. I think we can do that. For us, it's about the form, and so the rest of the bill is other folks' territory that I can't speak to. I'd be happy to answer any questions and let you know.
So because this takes the form away, are you not in support?
No. Chair Kinnegar, it doesn't take the form away.
It doesn't, okay.
As far as I know, okay. As far as the way I read it. The form, if you it says, is there a warrant? Is there a court order? Mm. Or is it an exigent circumstance? And then they ask to say briefly what that is, mm-hmm. Sign the form. I think it'd be the same difference if someone of a CPS worker comes in, show their ID, we could take a copy, attach it to the form, and we would be sure that that person is who they say they are, and they're here for the right reason, and Johnny could be pulled from class.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. Chair Kinnegar, members of the committee, Amanda Dalton. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Council of Police Associations, and we represent about 60 small and medium-sized law enforcement employees across the state, typically your frontline officers, many of who are conducting these investigations. And you on the panel probably have far more experience than I do, so I'm not going to comment on specific police policy because I'm afraid that Vice Chair Olson may challenge me on some of it. And would be. Or many of you. Ms. Satinsfield, the form is really how we got engaged in this conversation. I will say that many of our officers said it's not been a problem, but there have been occasions, as you heard, that the form did serve a potential to delay, and many times these investigations, it is our initial preliminary investigation or discussion with the child that needs to happen immediately, and so a form asking for a warrant, which typically wouldn't exist at this stage, or to require an officer to outline in writing what those exigent circumstances are on a document that potentially is discoverable in advance of any discussion with the actual child proved problematic. And so I think those changes that the School Boards Association making are spot on and exactly what we need. I want to, and I also was given permission by Kevin Campbell to offer the support by on behalf of the sheriffs and the chiefs in the Dash 7s, which are before you, which represent a negotiated product between DHS, OCDLA, the DAs, and all the law enforcement groups. I also want to thank Senator Gelsler for all of her work. This bill went through two policy committees on the Senate side, and so the senator has probably worked this bill harder than the majority of her bills. We went through the Health Policy Committee and then also Judiciary Committee. An important change in the Judiciary Committee that I want to point out on in the actual B and Gross bill in new sub 2, which doesn't narrow the application of this bill just to individuals that are victims of child abuse. And so we are not talking about suspects in this arena. And so I just wanted to clarify that for the record. And I also just a couple of the questions that were raised to the initial panel. Do you want to point out on line 10 and 11 of the bill that We did leave the may in the bill, which means that the investigator, either the law enforcement officer or the DHS investigator, has the discretion to bring in the principal or a teacher. I mean, this is really something that these folks are trained and trained to do. And if I decide that the teacher is going to make this student more comfortable and should be part of this initial discussion with the child, then the officer is absolutely going to do that. And so I thought that was an important point that came out of the Senate. And then with that, we just offer our support for the B7 and hope that the committee moves the bill forward. Thank you.
Okay. I know Senator Roblin is waiting very patiently, but Senator Gelster, can you come up and just briefly comment on this? Since you've also been waiting patiently for
Chair Kinney-Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Gelster, State Senator from Corvallis and Albany. I wanted to clarify that this bill did go through both the Human Services and the Judiciary Committee, and what I've really appreciated about everyone that's worked on this, you have now before you with the B7 amendment, a work product that is the result of great compromise, collaboration, and support of the schools, law enforcement, the district attorneys, OCDLA, and the Department of Human Services. If you spend a lot of time doing work in this area, that is an enormous feat that really speaks to the hard work that everyone has done. I also wanted to go back to the reason why this is so incredibly important. What we are talking about, what DHS does, and we're going to talk about this in another bill if we get to it later, is DHS investigates abuse within a family. DHS does not investigate abuse that occurs at a school or with school personnel. That is an entirely different process. So the reason that the DHS investigator or law enforcement is coming to the school is that there's been an allegation of abuse in the family. The protocol requires that when that occurs, if the child makes a disclosure, the interview stops, and then they move on to that next place within the protocol at the Child Abuse Assessment Center. If you are in a rural place, you can't immediately take a child to CARES Northwest. How do you get that child to that place? And because the child is in a safe place at school, if we haven't assessed whether or not there's an exigent circumstance, we risk sending that child back into that unsafe place. In terms of not disclosing the information, if the child has come to school that morning, made a disclosure to her teacher that her stepfather had sexually assaulted her the night before, that teacher makes the mandatory report, DHS comes out, that child has demonstrated a great deal of courage to share that. She doesn't want everybody in the school and the office to know about that, or he. So there's a privacy to the child. The last thing that I would point out is, if you think about, I absolutely agree, we need due process. There are great conversations to be had in general, whether it's child abuse or anything else, about recording of interviews. That's not what this bill is about. This bill is about the ability for a child to share their information with an investigator outside the presence of the person that they are accusing. And I would ask you to think for a moment, if a woman came forward to make an accusation of domestic violence and wanted to be interviewed, would we really say that she needed the permission of the abuser and for him to decide whether or not he would be in the room with her during that investigation? I don't think that we should do so. Children need to have the same respect and ability to tell their story, and it may not be substantiated, but they need the chance to make that. And finally, a school counselor cannot investigate child abuse. The statute requires that a mandatory reporter make a mandatory report when they have reasonable cause to believe that abuse may have occurred. The statute prohibits that person from doing their own investigation. Only law enforcement, a CPS worker, may do the child abuse investigation. So it would be inappropriate for a school counselor, if a school was lucky enough to have a school counselor, to be able to do that investigation.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We need to move on. All right. I'm going to suspend this and open it later. I'm suspending it. I see there's a lot of passion around it.
I'm not going to
win. I know that Senator Roblin has to be somewhere by 9. I want to open up that hearing on Senate Bill 277A. And if we have time, we will come back to this. Yes. And I think that Representative Helm is on his way. I think his staff are watching. Welcome. Cassie, could you read us the summary, please?
Senate Bill 277A increases the notice period for a landlord to terminate month-to-month or fixed-term rental agreement and require removal of a manufactured dwelling or floating home with an exterior in disrepair or deterioration from 30 days to 60 days. The bill allows a landlord to terminate rental agreements with 30 days' notice to the tenant if the manufactured dwelling or floating home creates a risk of serious or imminent harm and requires notice to include specific information on the disrepair or deterioration, including risk of harm. The bill requires the landlord to give a prospective purchaser as a tenant of the manufactured dwelling or floating home copies of the termination documents outlining maintenance issues and potential liability for repairs. And the bill declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, Senator Arne Roblin from Senate District 5, Coos Bay, Tillamook, and then into the valley in Falls City and Sheridan. This was a bill, I really haven't gotten into landlord-tenant stuff before, but I had a retired senator from my district, Senator Verger, who had a mobile home she was renting, and they got a notice, and it wasn't a difficult one for her to deal with, but she had a lot of other tenants that were around her who were really shook up and wondered what was going to happen to them and how we're going to deal with this. And she took this on, and when Senator Berger takes things on, others of us become there there to help her. So I just want to make that clear. We had a lot of conversations, and we put out a bill, and it got people excited. To, I think, the credit of the longstanding cooperation between tenants and landlords in mobile home parks, there's a group that works together, and they, after we got it going, decided they wanted to meet and have real conversations about this bill, and I give them all the credit in the world for the bill that's before you today, because they came to an agreement. You're going to hear some stuff. I hope you don't have to hear the whole list of everything they agreed to that was a repair and which wasn't a repair. I think you're going to get that on the record in written form instead of having to hear each and every one of them, because there's a lot of conversations that took place amongst everybody to get to that point. And I think that's important, because right now my belief is that because of the amendments and because of the bill that's sitting before you, tenants will know when they sign up to go into a park the expectations and where they're going to go, and those people who are there will be encouraged to do the things that would make you beautify and do other kinds of stuff, but they have to do the things that they've agreed to when they come in. It gives a little bit longer for people to get things repaired, and they can have a conversation with the park owner to make sure that they can't, if they can't get it done in that time, they can do other things. But it really sets, I believe, the parameters that will make it work for these places to can maintain them so it doesn't cause harm or injury to anybody, and also have real conversations in those places about what it should look like in the future and so on. So believe that some people were looking at the way the law was written before, and they felt like they had to go right down the line, and it created problems that I don't think needed to exist. And I'm pleased that the groups got together and were able to come up with this amended version. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator. For your record, Ken Helm, State Representative for House District 34. And I became involved with this bill because this summer an entity or company from California started using the existing law as cover for trying to harass some of my constituents. We have a very nice manufactured home park in the corner of my district called Heritage Village. It's filled with lots of very nice people who have worked hard all their life or are working hard now. They're very proud of their residences, and I was able to meet them and walk around with them. Met them a couple of times and understood their concerns and the stories of what was happening to them. From my view as an attorney that deals in land use matters, the letters that I was shown and the follow-up letters that the residents showed me relating to the condition of their homes, the appearance of the outside of their homes, and the claims of disrepair looked like harassment to me. Looked like a systematic effort to drive a few people out of the park, particularly the ones that actually owned the land under their homes. Mm-hmm. As you know, a lot of these are slips that are rented or leased. In this particular park, there was only a handful of places, though, where the resident owned the land under their manufactured home, and it looked to me to be an effort to try to root these folks out so that something else might happen to this land. And as you know, 50 acres of land inside an urban growth boundary is extremely valuable. But without going any further with intent and motives, what was happening to my folks was really egregious, and it really, really made me angry, because these are folks that, because of their income constraints or their plans for retirement, don't have a lot of latitude, just like the folks that we talk about all the time that are in need of affordable housing. When they get an eviction notice because of the appearance of the outside of their home, it is very traumatizing, right? They all of a sudden feel like all their work or their situation in life right now is on the line. And they're not like us dealing with problems every day. They're not attorneys. It's really, really very alarming to them. And that was happening to dozens and dozens of folks in Heritage Village. And I just received an email from one of the residents, again on May 13th, saying, Heritage Village has begun issuing evictions again. No warning letters this time. Two notices have been issued on our block, one to an elderly woman who just lost her husband this week. So it's continuing. And the real irony of this is these folks are getting eviction notices related to the appearance of the outsides of their homes when the park itself is stockpiling used manufactured homes on several lots within the development and just leaving them there for months until they find a place for them. And I experienced those myself. They don't look very nice at all. They sure look in disrepair to me. So there's a double standard going on there. I was really happy to be able to work with John Van Landingham on this. I have great faith, as the senator said, in that we now have a clearer statute and a balanced statute that folks, both on the landlord side and on the tenant side, seem to be comfortable with. And I would urge you to pass this out of your committee and send it on to the floor for a vote. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we've got a panel. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Senator and Representative Chuck Carpenter, John Van Landingham, and John DiLorenzo.
Thanks, sir.
That's between you guys.
Mediator?
Not exactly.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Van Landingham. I work as a lawyer for the Lane County Legal Aid / Oregon Law Center, and I am the person who drafted the amendments that this bill represents. I visited all three of the manufactured home parks that have been referred to in this fact situation, met with the residents starting last summer. I want to first note that I'm troubled by hearing what Representative Helm said about new notices. I intend to contact his office and find a legal aid lawyer in Washington County who can contact those tenants and see what's going on. This bill is an agreement between the landlord side and the tenant side. So I work with tenants. I want to introduce Rita Loberger. Wave your hand. Rita is the president of Manufactured Housing / Oregon State Tenants Association, the statewide association of tenants. Oddly enough, she lives in one of the three parks where these notices have been given out. Park residents want their landlord to maintain the parks, the homes in the park. They want reasonable rules to require that tenants maintain their homes and fix disrepair, because a home that's in disrepair affects the value of their homes. What they don't want is a landlord to use the statute that allows landlords to force repairs for aesthetic things, such as paint color, not peeling paint, just paint color, or air conditioners in windows. There's nothing wrong with the air conditioner. It's not falling down, just the fact that it doesn't look good to this particular landlord. They don't like the way it looks. Or lattice on a deck. And yes, those were among the things that were addressed to former Senator Joanne Verger with her home in a park here in Salem. Those are not disrepair. They're aesthetics. And what the bill will do is make it clear that that's not disrepair. That's not a basis for terminating a tenancy. With a new tenant, part of the compromise that we worked out with among the landlords, which is to say that with a new tenant, that can reset for aesthetic issues. But that's not disrepair for a current tenant. We also extended the time period for addressing disrepair from 30 days to 60 days, unless there's a risk of harm to tenants or property. That's what the bill does. This is something that we worked out. The Manufactured Housing Coalition has existed since the late 1990s. We had a hiccup last fall, but we came back together in January and started working on reaching an agreement here, and we've already started working on other issues for 2018 or 2019, and I hope we won't have another hiccup, and we'll continue to work, and we'll see you next February.
I'll check. Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney with Davis Wright Tremaine, and I serve as co-chair along with Mr. Van Landingham for the Manufactured Homes Landlord-Tenant Coalition. I'm also pleased that we have come to an accommodation together. As part of that accommodation, we agreed that we would read into the record various examples of what was repair and what were aesthetic items. We did that on the Senate side, and I have to acknowledge that my testimony in that regard was far from riveting. And so as Senator Roveland mentioned, what we will do, if with your permission, Madam Chair, is address a letter to you, which we will then file on OLIS, with a list of 31 non-inclusive items that indicate what are repair. One of the easiest ones is, for instance, need for paint versus choice of paint color. Need for paint is a repair item. Choice of paint color is an aesthetic consideration. And we have a list of those to hopefully establish some legislative history. So if a court encounters a certain circumstance, wants to know what the legislature intended by the distinction, there will at least be some guidance in the record to aid the court. And so provided that will work for you, Madam Chair, we'll do that in lieu of my otherwise riveting testimony.
That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chuck Carpenter. I'm Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We represent about 535 manufactured home communities throughout the state and close to 32,000 spaces. So I'd like to thank the Chair for all her support over the last year in trying to keep the coalition together. And we wholeheartedly support this this bill. This is the 10th coalition bill that we've been involved in, that I've been involved with. I think it provides a very good process for us to address some very controversial issues between the landlords and the homeowners. And we look forward to continuing that process. We will be back to you with another bill sometime in the future. And I'd like to thank both co-chairs for their hard work and bringing it together and making sure that we have a really good product. I'm very proud of the 10 coalition bills that we've done over the years and look forward to more. This will not be my last, and I think there'll be more coming down. And I think it saves a lot of people, although it maybe not for us, doesn't save us much angst, but I think it saves the legislative process a great deal of angst in trying to resolve these issues in a fair manner that's beneficial to both the homeowner and to the community owner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Van Landingham, Mr. Carpenter, I just want to congratulate you and commend you for the work that you're doing with the coalition, and I just for basically presenting that this is the model that works, and it helps us do our job much better. So I appreciate that work, and I hope other associations or coalitions can be developed around housing in our state again to help us all resolve the housing issues we're trying to resolve in a collaborative manner. So congratulate you on that and commend you, and thank you for continuing your work. Appreciate it.
Any other questions? I have.
Yeah, I too, Madam Chair. I appreciate their work too. That's all.
Ditto on all that. I just have a quick question on the 60 days. Is the 60 days for the repair to be completed or to be started? And was there any discussion about whether that was enough time?
So thank you for the question, Madam Chair. John Van Landingham, the statute already provides some exception if the repair can't be made. For example, painting the exterior of a home in the rain in December is not a good idea. And so the statute already allows the tenant to respond to the landlord and say, I can't do it in this amount of time. Okay. I think I can look it up if you want an exact answer.
Nope.
But rather than risk, I think it's 6 months, but sometimes I make mistakes.
Agreed. Okay. So no other questions? Great. Thank you so much.
Close the
public hearing on House Bill 277. I'm aware that our first bill is still on hold, but I'm going to go to the other bills. Thank you, Senator Gelser, for being very patient. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 268. Is that Senator Gelser? You like to call the other people up with you, or are you on your own?
Yes, the 268 people.
Okay. Bob Drundeff, Stacey Ayers, and Cassie, could you please read the summary?
Senate Bill 268A requires Department of Human Services to make certain records available to Disability Rights Oregon for reports of abuse of a child with a disability occurring in an educational setting when records are compiled under specified mandatory reporting and health information disclosure statutes.
I think so.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, state senator from Corvallis and Albany, and chair of the Senate Human Services Committee. Senate Bill 268 comes to you with strong support from the Senate and is the result of really many years of conversations that the three of us and some others have been having. This is the problem. As mentioned in the bill that I know that we'll come back to in a little bit so that we can get to Representative Sanchez's question, when DHS, we're all mandatory reporters of child abuse. A mandatory reporter has reasonable cause to believe that abuse has occurred. They call the child abuse hotline, and their expectation is that somebody will then go and investigate that abuse. The problem is that there are some holes where it's not clear that the department has the obligation or the mandate to go out and investigate that abuse. That includes abuse that takes place in a school district during the school day. And in a case that DRO brought to our attention a few years ago where it was particularly egregious, it was a special education classroom with nonverbal children, and the things that were happening in the classroom were fingernails being pulled out of the children being pinched, their limbs being dislocated in order to cause them to behave in an act of protest as a nonverbal child may, and to then be sent home from school. A member of that classroom made the mandatory report. It was not open for an investigation because the allegation was not against a family member. It was at the school. They were told to tell the school. The school's policy relies on the DHS investigation. So they called law enforcement. Law enforcement said, if DHS has screened it out, we are not going to do anything about it. So these kids were left in the same place. I've had similar circumstances when I've made calls, especially around kind of our seclusion and restraint law. In particular, about 2 years ago, I had a father that called. He was very upset. He had arrived at a school district to like drop off a lunch or something, and he found his child completely naked in an illegal seclusion cell, banging his head on the floor. There was a bowl of water like for a dog, and he had been in this room for about an hour. I thought this probably hits my mandatory reporter obligation. I made the report, and the screener said, sorry, it's at a school. There's nothing we can do about it. It will be closed at screening. Call law enforcement. Not clearly a crime. There is often a difference between a crime and an abuse. So this is a big hole, and it particularly leaves at risk children that cannot talk about what's happened to them, which is why Disability Rights Oregon is involved. As you know, DHS has some resource issues. We're working really hard to strengthen the screening process and the investigation process and adding more investigations to DHS. It's not something that DHS would not want to do, but whether it's practical to make that happen at this point is difficult. So the solution that we came up with, or frankly that Stacey and Bob came up with, because they're both really smart, is to handle this in a similar way that we have in the past around teacher sex abuse, which is they can't open the call, but they have provided that information to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, that is a licensing entity that does have some investigatory authority, even though it wouldn't be an abuse piece. In this case, it could be a coach, it could be a classified staff. Not everybody is within TSPC. So now, with this bill, DHS would notify Disability Rights Oregon when there is an allegation about a child with a disability who's being abused on a school district campus, as the protection and advocacy organization for Oregon, Disability Rights Oregon does have some investigatory authority. The other benefit of this is we will be able to better quantify what is the number of investigations that we're looking at, so we could get a sense of what is that fiscal. I very much wish that we could just go out and do these investigations, but I remain very committed to the idea that DHS right now is really struggling. They need more resources, and we need to know exactly what we're doing before we add more to the plate. And I want to be clear, I have never heard DHS say, we do not wish to investigate these. I've heard DHS be honest about what is the capacity given the extreme underfunding and lack of support that the legislature has given to DHS over the last 10 to 12 years. So I urge your support of the bill.
Great.
Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Bob Jundeff, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon, and what you have just witnessed is why I so admire Senator Gelzer and her ability to advocate for the needs of children and adults with disabilities. She's outlined the purposes in the background of this bill far better than I could. And what I would just say is that this is really an effort of our organization to step in, up and try to provide some extra protection for highly vulnerable children in an era in which there isn't state money to provide that type of protection. So our organization, while not robustly funded, feels that this is an area that is so important that we want to be able to get better information so that we can investigate situations when it seems appropriate to do so. So thank you, Senator Gelzer. Thank you, Stacy, for working with us to be able to find a way to do that.
Chair Kenny Geiger, members of the committee, I would echo the sentiments, but in reverse, I guess, working with smart people and really being collaborative and trying to make necessary changes. I think, as Senator Gelzer pointed out, there's...
Stacy, could you please give your name for the record?
I'm sorry. Stacy Ayers. I supervise the Child Protective Services Program for the Department of Human Services. This is an issue that we've been working on for quite a long time. It's a bill that's been put forward and has kind of a number of different iterations. When the circumstance that was first brought to the attention of the school, the circumstance that Senator Gelzer is referring to, it's appalling. I mean, the circumstance that was described in the screening report that I read, I was appalled. And you will never hear me or anybody, I hope you never hear anybody from the department say we don't think we should interview or investigate those types of allegations. You will certainly never hear me say that. And it's a situation where we often talk about systemic issues, and this is one. And this is one where I think we brought people, with the support of Senator Gelzer and the leadership of the senator, brought people together who had similar views about what needed to be done, coming at it from different perspectives, and came up with something that will help us in the future. First, identify how big the issue is, and we'll be able to quantify the numbers, and then identify specifically whether or not and how we go about addressing the issue in the future. So I would just leave it at that. Thank you.
Okay, question? Representative.
Thank you. I'm curious at law enforcement's response. One, because everything that the senator outlined is easily a criminal offense, is the way you outline it. And so I'm curious what Disability Rights will do with this information, whether this becomes just ends up being a third-party report back to law enforcement to then repeat the investigation, and what does this look like?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Noble, the process that we normally take when we receive a complaint of abuse and neglect is that we will contact a parent or guardian to inform them that we have this information and ask them if they would like us to take a next step in order to find out what happened. Normally they do, of course. And then we will contact the school and we will ask to interview people who are involved in that situation in order to find out as best as we can what happened. We compile that information, we bring it back to the parent, and we also share it with the school and with, if appropriate, law enforcement. So our role is really one of as an investigatory body in gathering information, putting it into a form. Sometimes we will also make recommendations to the officials of the school or another agency about what our observations are. But that's as far as our role is in terms of doing that. So under federal and state law, we have a role that is one of really opening the doors to places that are not open to other people. So the law allows us to go into institutions in order to investigate situations that a normal public member could not. So just in a parallel type of situation quickly is that we were given this power because for years in institutions that serve people with mental illness or developmental disabilities that no one from the outside was allowed in. So if there was concerns about conditions in those institutions, if there was concerns about abuse in the institutions, if someone came to the institution and said, I'd like to come in and take a look, they were told you can't come in because we have to protect the confidentiality of the people who live there. And so our organization was given specific authority to go in with the understanding that we continue to have the same confidentiality responsibilities as people who work there. But in order to open the door, in order to make sure that there are some outside eyes that could get in, and so that's really the role that we play in these situations, to be outside eyes that can come in, see what's going on, and make sure that that information gets to the appropriate places where it can be addressed.
And if I may, Representative Noble, one of the questions I was asked on the floor when carrying the bill was, is it appropriate to name a particular organization to do this work? The reason it was in this case, this isn't a new responsibility. It's very consistent with the federal authority and expectation of the Protection and Advocacy Committee, and they have a long and professional history of doing this type of work. It fits within their mandate, their authority, and it's easy to allow that transfer of information because the confidentiality laws allow that.
So I guess a follow-up comment is my concern, at least the way I'm understanding it, is it's hard to believe that anything like this would exist, well, exist period today, but exist in an institution, a school, and not have the school personnel at least complicit, you know what I'm looking for, word, in knowing that it's going on. So reporting back to those people who already know what's going on doesn't satisfy me in my career in law enforcement to actually take it through the system and hold people accountable for treating people in this manner. So I don't understand it completely, and maybe this is a subject offline, but at some point I'd like to see some resolution to holding people accountable.
So Chair Kenny Garner, oh, I really do know you and know how to say your name. Chair AKG.
Yes. And, there you go.
And Representative Noble. I share that concern and hope for that very much. The thing that I do think would help with this is that it's really an unfortunate kind of feedback loop that the process is stuck in right now, because you have policies that speak to other procedures. So in 2009, when we worked on what was then House Bill 2062 that had to do with sexual conduct between school personnel and students. So a teacher or a coach is sending sexting messages to students, which you should not do, but it's also not sexual abuse, so it's not a crime. The problem was that the policies within the schools to address that all pointed to DHS, and that they couldn't take action until after the completion of a DHS investigation. That DHS investigation could never occur because DHS didn't have the authority to investigate because it was non-family abuse. So you have this stuck point. I think the same thing happened in the case that we described, and I believe that was in Gresham, actually,
yeah.
That it was you know, everybody kind of pointed to, well, if this was really an issue, the screeners wouldn't have screened it out. The screeners weren't screening it out because it didn't hit a level of concern. They screened it out because screening out doesn't mean that something didn't happen. It just means a whole variety of things, which also has a chilling effect on those reporters. So the individual person within the classroom that made this report in a very vulnerable way that involved her supervisor and her coworkers, what she learned from that is, I thought I exercised my mandatory abuse reporter obligation, but apparently that wasn't abuse. And that also becomes a problem.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. So is there also the need, and any of you could answer this, is there also a need for better information and training for law enforcement? I mean, my reaction as a former police officer was, I wouldn't walk away from that. Mm-hmm. And I'd be charging somebody, and I would take that child. So I don't quite understand that piece, or maybe I'm missing something.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Gorsuch, and members of the committee, your point is not lost on me. It is a topic that comes up repeatedly when we talk about child abuse allegations, authority to investigate, and the connection between the criminal codes and persons' crimes, assaults, sex abuse. Every one of them almost specifically is referred to in the child abuse definitions. And so it is... I will say that I think law enforcement at times has similar struggles with resources as DHS does, and oftentimes you will hear, and I've been doing this for a long time, and I had stints in law enforcement as well. You will hear about those resource issues, and you will hear about things like, we're only able to, you know, we're not going to be able to move forward on an investigation where you have a child who's nonverbal. They're not able to be a victim. It's going to be really difficult to prove. There may not be physical evidence, or you're going to have information that isn't necessarily corroborated by people. So a lot of different issues. There's a training component of it too, but there's a resource issue, and it's very real.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So it sounds almost like you're acting like an ombudsman. You know, you're not only doing problem solving, a service function, but also seeing what are the different issues that continually rise to the surface so that you can inform public policy, where we need to target training, education, those kinds of things. That's how I hear this.
Chair Kittigar, that's absolutely correct. And I would just say that even though it's hard to quantify, sunshine is the best antiseptic. Mm-hmm. So when information gets out, people actually do take notice, and I think that, you know, the vast majority of people are working in good faith, and if they recognize a problem, they'll
absolutely
want to address it.
And Chair Kenny Geyer, if I may, members of the committee, I suspect that one of the things that will come from this, in addition to just the being able to figure out how big the issue is that they will have an opportunity at Disability Rights Oregon to document many of these things and potentially put together packages essentially that will be a case. And I don't think there's a prevention for them to then provide that information to the other entities, DHS and law enforcement at that time of, here's what we learned during our interviews, our conversations, and other information that was gathered. I think that may also help to push things along, as it were.
And Bob, do you have any sense of how many new FTE, how much you have to grow, where your funding is going to come from? It's all on you.
Representative Kenny Guy, these are uncertain times.
There's some truth to that.
Well, to say the least.
Our lodestar is to try to do the right thing. Yeah. And hopefully if we do, we'll attract the resources to be able to get it done.
Okay. Great. All right. Thank you so much. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 268. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 819. So, Senator Gelser, and would you like Arthur Towers and John Devlin to join you or come in a separate panel?
If they like.
Are you they look comfortable. We'll leave you there.
What's the plan?
Okay, come on up.
Come on up.
And Cassie, in the meantime, can you read the summary, please?
Senate Bill 819A expands the duties and responsibilities of the Critical Incident Response Team, CERT, assigned to investigate a fatality of a child resulting from abuse. The bill details membership of the CERT and requires DHS to supply the team with all available records and information and establishes requirements for case review, records maintenance, and initial progress and final report. And limits the availability of records and the CERT members in judicial and administrative proceedings. The bill requires the team to submit initial progress and final report to DHS within the specified timelines, and requires the team to recommend to DHS improvements to the child welfare system specific to the case under review. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage.
Great. Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Olson, Vice Chair Sanchez, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, State Senator from Corvallis and Albany, and Chair of this committee on the other side. Senate Bill 819, I want to give my presentation to you in two pieces. There is the part of what it does, then there is an additional conversation that we tried to incorporate into the bill that we will be bringing you an amendment next week that takes that conversation out of this bill so that we can work on it in the interim. But I'd like to get to that second part first and talk to you about what would be left in the bill should you choose to adopt our amendment. So in over a decade ago, then Governor Ted Kulongoski, responding to concerns about some very concerning issues that happened actually in foster care, created something that was called the Critical Incident Response Team. At that time, it was a voluntary process that the director of the Department of Human Services could pull together to do not a fact-finding case, not to do discipline in the department, not to build things for a law enforcement case, but to look at systemic policy issues within the department to see, are there things that we could do better that we've learned from this circumstance that is really difficult that we could take and protect children better in the future and improve our practice. After that, in 2007, we passed a bill, and it's actually been mentioned here a couple times today, called Carley's Law. Within Carley's Law, Carley was a constituent of mine who was murdered when she was 3 years old after having been the subject of child abuse investigations three times in the prior 9 months, all of which were unsubstantiated. And despite the significant media attention in my non-Portland part of the state and the significance of that issue, that situation did not receive a CERT, although it pointed to a variety of systemic issues that could improve the process. So when we passed Carley's Law that really made some significant changes to the way that child abuse investigations happen in Oregon, we added the mandatory CERT, that a CERT take place when there is a fatality of a child that has been basically the subject of a department investigation within the prior 12 months. The intention of the law at that time was that we would be picking up those things where the department had unsubstantiated an allegation or when there had been multiple calls to the hotline that had been closed at screening kind of immediately before the death occurred, to better understand, are we asking the right questions at screening? Mm. Is the investigation going the right way? Whatever. What we have learned since that time is that the language was not broad enough to pick up everything that we think that we need to be able to look at in these cases to do the work that the department is trying to do around improving screening and assessment. And so the first thing that this bill does in Section 1 is it more clearly describes what we're trying to pick up in that 12 months prior to the fatality. And again, this is specific to fatality. The child at this point has died as the result of abuse or neglect. This is not an ongoing issue. This is not a foster care issue necessarily. It is a fatality. The child has died. So what we would make clear is that the CERT would be mandatory if the child was in the custody of the department at the time of the death, which is currently the law, the child, and what we're adding is the child's sibling or any other child living in the household with the child was the subject of a CPS assessment within the prior 12 months. So sometimes one child in a household is the subject subject of the investigation, and the child that then is deceased was maybe an ancillary part of that investigation, but we weren't picking that kid up, even though those dynamics might have been similar. And then the child's sibling or any other child living within the household had a pending child welfare or adoption case within the prior 12 months preceding the fatality. Again, that is going to looking at the whole family and recognizing that we don't always have legal relationships. There are households that live together, and they may not be siblings. They may be children of romantic partners or roommates or whatever. And then the last is to really pick up those closed at screening reports, because the plain language of the statute as it currently exists says that there was an investigation. What we have seen since that time is that there have been multiple closed at screening. So we want to make sure that we're looking at if there was someone where there were multiple calls and it was closed at screening and then the child died, why were those reports closed at screening? Most of the rest of the bill is very consistent with what the protocol was prior to February. One of the other weird things that happened, the bill was passed in 2007, but the rule was not adopted until February of this year, so about 10 years later. But this kind of narrows some of that down to make sure who is on it. There is a recent cert in which the director chose to include a legislator. I got a chance to do that, and a judge. We talked in the Senate side about making public members, like somebody from the Judicial Department and a legislator, a part of that process, because you can't share necessarily the discussion of the policy issues that were there. And that information can be important and help us not make anecdotal laws, to really get in there and see what's going on. There was concern on the Senate side in my committee that if you were a member that was assigned to that, either it could become very political or it would take a lot of time and people might not have the time to attend. So we made that discretionary, that the director may choose, you know, depending on the case, to have a public member, and that's going to be at the request of the director. So in some cases, it might be really important to include a CASA, or it might be important to include a CRB person, depending on what the issues are. But that will be case dependent. And it's never a person that is specifically involved in the case. This is outside folks, because again, the goal isn't to look for fault. It's to look at systemic issues. How do we systemically take, you know, the high level, 1,000-foot in the air view to look at how is our system built so that we can do better for kids? The bill does make a change in the rule. The prior protocol said that the team would stop investigating the incident if the incident that led to it was the result of the action of one or more department employees or staff, and it was inconsistent with policy or rule. That really could go to training issues. You know, do people know what the rule is? So this clarifies that you will complete that in that way. And then the bill also talks about what goes into that final written report. And this is something that Clyde Psyche has done a phenomenal job at doing. If you go and look in OLIS, I've provided links to some of the certs. All of the cert reports are online. But you can see the difference between what the CERT reports have been under Clyde Psyche and what the CERT reports have been in the past. And you're looking at something, you know, that is a comparison between a 1-to-3-page document to one that is a 16-to-19-page document that not only goes through the entire history of the case, but talks about systemic issues, how the department will follow up on those systemic issues, and what the timeline is and the measurement to make sure that we've done those. And that's really important, because the CERTs that we do have a lot of really great information in them, but we haven't had a way to really quantify and move forward on them, and Clyde has done a great job. It's my belief that should not be dependent on who the director of the Department of Human Services is. I personally would love it if Clyde would be the director forever and ever and ever and ever, but I think Mrs. Psyche has different opinions on that. I thought maybe I could bake her brownies or something, but I don't think that is enough, and probably not for him either. So that's why that is there. The bill also makes it clear that the report becoming public will not be made public if it would compromise an ongoing investigation of a law enforcement agency. That's really important. When there's a crime, we don't want the public transparency of this to get in the way of justice. Now, so that's what that does. We've worked really hard on the bill. There is not opposition to those pieces. One of the elements that came up that does not currently exist around the CERT was what should people be able to be interviewed about in a civil proceeding that might come out of one of these cases and that CERT information. So on the Senate side, we had added some language that protected some information from being released. Probably the way that we drafted that went a little too far and kept things out of the hands of plaintiffs that you know, caught the attention of the Oregon Travelers Association. So since that time, we have been working back and forth with OTLA and DHS and DOJ to try to figure out where that balance is. Where the decision that everybody came to last night was that the best thing to do at this point, because it is a new issue that is actually unrelated to the policy that we're trying to move forward in this bill, is to take that question out of this bill and have a work group in the interim that is looking at the issue of records so that we can get it the right way. So you will be receiving an amendment that would basically remove the language, just completely delete the language on page 3, lines 34 to 45, and on page 4, lines 1 to 18. And that just will just be exactly how it is today. The one other change that will go into that amendment, to be clear, and I want to make sure that DOJ hears that I heard them in this request, is that at the very end, it says that the team can come back together after the conclusion of the criminal trial. Right now, that says that they shall come back. We'd like to change that to a may. And the purpose for that is that the CERT team is not, and I really have to emphasize this, it's not, they don't investigate people, there aren't witnesses. It's not a fact-finding thing. It's not about assigning fault. It's about understanding how the policies work together and whether or not we can make policy and systemic changes that make kids safer. Sometimes we can also get that information from law enforcement or the district attorney that's putting together a criminal case, and because they are talking to different people, they may have identified different systemic issues. So what we wanted was to create this place where this group has the statutory authority to come back and discuss this kind of confidential information with that outside information, but it has to be after the case, because we don't want law enforcement or the DA to have to compromise. How do they gain information? Was it outside of the discovery process? And but we want to make that a may instead of a shall. But it's a good bill. I think we're in a good place. Nobody opposes the bill at this point. And I am incredibly grateful to the Department of Justice, to DHS, to Clyde Psyche in particular, and to Stacey Ayers, who have put hours and hours and hours of work into this since January, and Representative Stark took a picture in the hallway in which I said, and I want to on the record, today is one of the best day of my life, and I have the Department of Justice and the Oregon Department of Human Services Child Welfare to thank for that.
So. Mm. Wow. A quick question before you go ahead, in terms of the shalls and mays, I think you were saying that you the intent was to say it may include a state senator or state representative, but here still on line 1 on page 2, members of the critical incident response team shall include at a minimum, and then it includes the state senator. So if you...
No. That so what you have to look down is at the following may be assigned. So if you look at line 7, so the A is
members
shall.
I missed that.
And the reason that it specifically says, the reason that we had to call them out, because I thought we could just say public members, we get into a separation of powers issue. So the DHS director can't appoint a judge. That has to be done by the Chief Justice. And the DHS director cannot appoint a legislator. That has to be a presiding officer. So that's why they're called out, but it's in the may section instead of the shall.
I got that. Thank you. Miss that. Thank you.
And if you are called upon because the speaker or the president, I just want to make this very clear in case you're worried about the time commitment, you can say no. Right. You don't have to do it if you don't want to.
Right. Okay, good. Thank
you. To say that in there?
it's on the record now.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Towers with the Oregon Travelers Association, and we are enthusiastically supporting the bill with the change that Senator Gelser talked about. I did want to come visit with the committee, though, regardless, because I do want to talk about the role that our members play in fighting for children and fighting for justice and improvements in the system through the civil justice process. Our members seek to hold wrongdoers accountable for the lifelong impact the trauma has on the child or on their loved ones if the child dies from the abuse. We seek to improve the child welfare system through accountability and transparency. And the one dilemma that we have is that our members come in at the tail end after the abuse has occurred and many horrific things have happened, and then we're engaged. And so we want to be more part here at the front end as the laws get created to make matters better, because you know, obviously, or it should be stated, you know, obviously it would be better if our members didn't have any of these cases. That's the goal. But in the meantime, we are where we are. We also have a lot of sympathy and understanding for DHS. We don't question anyone's motives. Everyone's, you know, shooting for the same thing. We're happy to be part of the team, even though we end up in the civil justice system as being adversarial with DOJ because they have a role in that system to protect the state interest, and we're protecting the child's interest. It's not, I don't want to overstate that. DOJ doesn't give a darn about the kid. But I do want to point out that in that process, it is an adversarial process. With that, we want to talk about the concerns we had with the part that's coming out. Just to flag briefly for the committee, how this piece works on the civil justice side at the end, and just hopefully provide helpful information as we figure this out going forward. But again, we're gung-ho about the bill. Been pleased to work with Senator Gelser, and you know, just the whole thing's going to work out fine, but we did want to raise these issues.
Thank you. Morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is John Devlin. I'm a lawyer from Portland, but I handle a variety of civil rights cases, including cases for children in the foster care system who've suffered abuse or neglect. In fact, I did a multi-week trial in 2011 in Multnomah County that sprung out of the very first cert in 2004, a horrific case. And I do want to stress what Arthur said at the outset. Aaron Knott, the DOJ liaison, is somebody I know. We've worked together on other things. We're going to collaborate on this, and we understand that that's an important thing to do. And to also stress that a number of us that handle these cases regularly would love to never have one of these cases again. Mm-hmm. I have a daughter who's 9 years old, and if I never have one of these cases again, I would be a very happy person. I have other things that I'd like to do with my time. And many of us are former prosecutors who are very into this work, and we do it because we believe that the civil justice system does have a role in promoting accountability and transparency in this area. And so that raises the concern that we have, which is that the proposed Section 7 does, in our view, go against transparency and accountability and basically tries to cloak the cert process in secrecy that does not exist now. And so just to walk through a couple of specific examples to help you understand, right now, as proposed in the bill, some records, but not all, of the cert process would be turned over to the representatives of a child or the child's family or personal representative if the child had been deceased. And remember, these are all cases of severe abuse, death. I mean, these are the most serious cases. And so some records would be turned over, but their use would be highly limited in what could be done with them by the child's representative. And so just a couple of examples of that are, and a number of you who have law enforcement backgrounds will appreciate this, that there are some situations in a cert process where you are going to talk to people who were involved and have notes about that. There's been a recent change, I believe, where the HR folks have been kind of included in this process. And so in whatever form it comes up, if there's a contemporaneous statement very close in time to the events where someone who is a fact witness gives a statement about what happened to someone, someone in my position may get that statement. But then if I literally ask, as it's drafted, if I'm in a deposition and I ask that person, they say, I don't remember because it's 2 years down the road. And I say, well, we use police reports like this all the time. Well, let me show you your statement. Did you say this? Objection. You are not allowed to ask any questions about that statement that person gave. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm going to start with the not remembering honestly, because that certainly does happen. And I'm not trying to cast aspersions on people, but there are other situations where someone gives an inconsistent answer to something they said 2 years ago. I literally would not be allowed to ask them about that inconsistent answer.
Could you just wrap up your thoughts?
Yes.
We got one more bill to hear and a couple
sorry,
to work.
Chair, yep. One other thing is that the documents as a whole would be produced to us, but we would not be allowed to admit any of them into evidence. So a court or a jury would not see them. And so, for example, just to give one more quick example, in my trial, there were human resource documents that were produced to me, and several members of the staff were disciplined as a result of the event. The lawyers for DOJ, doing their job as the tort lawyers defending the agency, basically made arguments that it was okay, you know, what they did was okay. And in that case, I was allowed to then bring up that DHS itself had disciplined the people. Under this bill, I would not be allowed to do that. I could literally have a document saying that policies and procedures were not followed, and I would not be allowed to tell the jury that. One last thing, Chair, is that it, as drafted, it talks about civil and administrative proceedings, and I honestly don't know what the definition of administrative proceedings is, but it worries me that it could cover legislative inquiries, governor's task forces, and different things. So it's not just civil cases. It's anybody trying to look behind the cert and get more information. So that's why we have concerns.
And Madam Chair, to clarify, all of that is coming out.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, yeah,
that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. We'll work together.
And I just want to toss one more thing in, because I just want to be clear in the statement I made earlier. You know, DOJ does care about the kids.
Yes. You did. You made that clear. Thank you. All right. Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 819. Committee, can you stay a few more minutes? We've got a very short one, a public hearing, and Fred Steele has been very patient. So we're opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 59. Cassie, please read the...
Senate Bill 59B authorizes the long-term care ombudsman to appear in existing protective proceeding and to file motion to remove the fiduciary, modify powers of fiduciary, or terminate protective proceeding. The bill limits information the long-term care ombudsman may disclose to the court about a resident of a long-term care facility, residential facility, or adult foster home, and makes certain visitor reports and information disclosed by the long-term care ombudsman confidential in the court file absent good cause. The bill declares an emergency effective on passage.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, I'm Fred Steele. I'm the state long-term care ombudsman and director of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and I appreciate a few minutes. I'm hoping this is the exact bill you want to see in the last few minutes of the committee hearing, because it is short and sweet, especially as we've whittled it down from what was introduced was a little bit more robust and what even I thought we needed from our office and this authority we're asking for. It's been whittled down to what's in this B and gross bill, which, given the authorities that our office already has relating to guardianships and conservatorships, and actually before I go there, I'll take the quick step back. Our office is an advocate, and we are the chief advocates both in our long-term care ombudsman program and our residential facilities ombudsman program, advocates for residents in these care facility settings. That's well over 50,000 Oregonians. We generally advocate for their rights and dignity and the way they live and the care they receive in care facility settings, but also address rights violations issues when it comes to guardians or conservators, these court-appointed decision makers for individuals. We already have relatively extensive authority in the protective proceedings statute in ORS Chapter 125. To get involved, we can object to certain requests by a guardian or conservator or proposed guardian or conservator. We can make a motion to the court. As I arrived at the office a year and a half ago, though, I learned that there were general barriers. We didn't really utilize this authority. We get frequent guardianship petitions in the mail. They're required to notice us, but we haven't really done much with them. And the reason being is what's in this bill is the confidentiality of the information that we contain and the inability to keep it confidential once it goes to the courts. Conveniently, I had worked on legislation similarly back in 2009. For adult protective services over at Department of Human Services to ask for these same authorities to keep that information confidential once it goes to the court. So what's in this bill is actually just borrowed from language that is now in statute in ORS 125.012 is essentially extending this authority or creating the authority to keep that information confidential, both for the ombudsman programs to share it and then for the courts to be able to keep it confidential. Otherwise, it's just part of public records. So I can give case examples if you're interested, but I can also just kind of stop there and answer any questions that you have.
A lot of judicial kinds of things today. Any questions? Sounds good. Thank you for keeping it simple.
Yeah,
I'm going to close the Senate Bill 59. I do not think we're going to be able to get back to the public hearing on 101. I'm sorry. I know both Vice Chair Sanchez and Representative Noble had questions, and so when it comes up next time, you are first on deck for questions. I invite you to talk with people beforehand. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 101, and if you can bear with me, we'll try to get through this really fast. These are all, we're going to do work for bills that you've heard before, and do not seem to have any controversy, passed with very big majorities in the Senate, and just have a couple of small technical changes. So, Vice Chair. Oh, that's right, I got to open it. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 244A. Vice Chair Olson.
Okay, so Madam Chair, I move the dash three amendments into Senate Bill 244A.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the dash three amendments dated May 8, 2017. Is there any discussion? Cassie, could you just please read quickly what that is?
Yeah, so the Senate Bill 244 clarifies Department of Human Services notification requirements for suspected or substantiated child abuse involving child care agencies. The dash three clarifies the provision notifying Oregon Youth Authority, county juvenile departments, or developmental disability services at DHS about the report or suspected or founded abuses.
Okay. Any discussion on that? Any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, it is adopted.
So, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 244A as adopted to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair also moves Senate Bill 244A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Ashley, please call the roll.
Yes.
Aye.
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 Yes.
Vice Chair Olson. Aye.
Vice Chair Sanchez.
Aye. Aye. Motion passes. Do we have a carrier? Anyone like to be a carrier for this?
Okay, do it.
Okay, Representative Peluso is the carrier, and we close the work session on Senate Bill 244A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 310.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 310.
Vice Chair also moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated April 28, 2017. Any discussion? Cassie, just can you please give us a quick summary?
Yep. Senate Bill 310 is the Vertical Housing Development Zone Bill with a dash one amendment. Defines displacement as a household forced or moved from a current residence due to certain conditions, and requires the city and county to consider the potential displacement of households within the proposed Vertical Housing Development Zone.
You may recall this is a very simple bill that just moves the administration of this from OHCS back to the cities. Representative Bueller came and testified on it twice. This is Senator Boquist's bill, and the amendment is simply asking for a study on displacement if there is displacement possibility. And all the parties have agreed to that, correct? Thumbs up. Okay. Any discussion on that amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, it is adopted.
So, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 310 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair also moves Senate Bill 310 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the bill? Seeing none, Ashley, please call the roll.
Yes.
Aye.
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 Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. The bill passes. Representative Stark, you are one of the sponsors. Would you like to carry this bill?
I'm willing to. I think Representative Bueller was
hoping to. Oh, yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. Correct.
That makes
Thank
sense.
You. All right, we will assign Representative Bueller and close the work session on Senate Bill 310. Do it again. All right, open a work session on Senate Bill 948A.
And Madam Chair, I move... Actually, yes. Senate Bill 948 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Vice Chair also moves Senate Bill 948A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Cassie, could you please read us a quick summary?
Mm-hmm. Senate Bill 948 prohibits residential facilities, residential facilities receiving public funds from hiring an individual found to have committed abuse, and requires DHS to adopt rules to specify the types of abuse that disqualify an individual from working at a residential facility.
Okay, any discussion on the bill? Yes, Representative Newman.
Just real quick, I'm going to be a yes on this bill, but one thing that I'm kind of concerned about, just to put a little blurb out here, is that people who find themselves in trouble with child abuse are people that are oftentimes the deliverers of care, and it's hard for these to hire people in these kinds of jobs. So I worry that maybe we're if we shrink it down too much and make it too hard, we're going to eliminate some people from being able to be caregivers in this. But I'll be a yes on it because I think that it's in the right direction.
That's a very fair concern. We need to make sure that we also give these people support so we don't lose too much of the workforce in this area.
Yeah.
Any other discussion on the bill? Seeing none, Ash, would please call the roll.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
Representative
Nierman?
Representative Neville?
Aye.
Representative Caluso?
Aye.
Representative Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kinnegar?
Hi, Senate Bill 948A passes. Do we have a carrier for this? Vice Chair Sanchez, thank you. And close the work session on Senate Bill 948A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1027A.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1027A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 1027A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Cassie, could you please read the summary?
Senate Bill 1027 permits the transfer of ABLE account funds to the estate of a deceased designated beneficiary or to another eligible individual's ABLE accounts, and also prohibits DHS and the Oregon Health Authority from seeking payment of the ABLE account except as provided by federal law.
Okay, any discussion on this bill? Seeing none, Ash, would please call the roll.
Representative
Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative
Meek?
Aye.
Representative
Nierman?
Aye.
Representative
Caluso?
Aye.
Representative
Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Sanchez?
Aye.
Chair Kinnegar? Aye. Senate Bill 1027A passes, and we will assign Representative Hayden to carry it. Close the work session on Senate Bill 1027A. We will be assigning the rest of the bills that we've heard for work to be worked next week, probably on May 23rd. We'll carry over any if we have to, but May 19th, tomorrow is our deadline to assign anything for work session. May 25th, we're going to have an informational hearing on House Bill 2007, which we passed out of our committee, but the amendment came pretty late. We had a nice description of it. There was no opposition, but since the word got out about it, there's been some concerns around the historic designation part of it, and so we want to have Ways and Means is not a place where they can really give it a full vetting policy-wise. There are discussions happening about it, some amendments being made, so we will do that next Thursday, and we will be possibly offering a couple of field trips, optional field trips. One might be going to the DHS headquarters and getting a tour there. So we'll keep you informed, and until then, we're adjourned. Okay. So we'll keep you informed, and until then, we're adjourned. Okay.